In recent years, many irreplaceable archaeological sites and artworks have been lost to the ravages of war, vandalism, theft, floods, natural disasters, and even overenthusiastic tourists. But new technologies are enabling a growing effort to create digital replicas of these treasures. So even if the originals are lost, we have an accurate record of what they looked like. In an article called The Factory of Fakes in the November 28th issue of The New Yorker, the magazine's features director Daniel Zalewski profiles a digital mediation workshop called Factum Arte and its founder Adam Lowe, who has led the effort to reproduce King Tut's tomb and other archaeological sites, and also some Renaissance paintings. I'm very pleased to welcome Daniel Zalewski to our show now.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Who is Adam Lowe, and how did he come to found the digital mediation workshop Factum Arte?
Well, Adam is a trained artist. He began as a painter, and over time he became obsessed as an artist with printmaking. And he actually did a lot of artwork in which he would obtain objects that he had dredged up from the bottom of the Thames River, and then he would use printing technology to kind of create reproductions of the relief of the Thames River. And over time, he became a master printmaker. Other professional artists started using him as a printmaker. And now, an international gallery of famous artists, including Anish Kapoor and Maya Lin, use him as a way of using 3D printing technology to realize sculptures at his studio in Madrid.
Was he always using 3D printing? Didn't he start before
he
the
did.
Advent of 3D printing?
He's a master of various printing technologies, including silkscreen. And when, in the late 90s, it became apparent that 3D printing was the future, he embraced that technology and then became the kind of go-to guy in the art world when you have a sculptural idea on your computer screen and you don't know how to execute it.
But isn't this just a continuation of something that was going on for a long time throughout the course of art history? There would be printmakers who would do copies of famous paintings, and that's how people learned about them in other countries of Europe before the advent of newspapers and then, of course, television and other things, books that would have spread that information.
Absolutely. I mean, the Victorian Albert Museum in London is actually kind of the mother lode for the Victorian idea about the copy, which was a very esteemed idea back in the day. There's a kind of cast quartz in which many of the world's most famous sculptures, including Michelangelo's David, are archived there in copy form, and many of the originals are now destroyed, so they're the only remaining copy.
And Michelangelo's David can be seen in Rome in two versions.
Absolutely, yes. One thing that's worth noting, though, is that modern conservation practice would frown on it in some ways because making a plaster cast in the traditional way does destroy some of the original work when you are, it's an abrasive process.
Although when I was an art student, those plaster casts were in every classroom that I ever studied in. You begin your article with a look at King Tut's tomb in the Valley of the Kings of Egypt. Why was that particular site chosen for reproduction?
Well, it is the most famous site in the Valley of the Kings because of the fame of King Tut. And so up to 2,000 people a day visit that tomb. It's actually also one of the smallest.
So tourism was ruining it?
Yeah, because of our sweat and our breath. It's very hot in that tomb. I've been there, and people exude a lot of moisture when they go in. And what happens as a result is that the plaster on the wall expands and contracts in response to that moisture. The Egyptians, as one would imagine, envisioned it being a sealed tomb for all of eternity, and they had created actually exquisite conditions for it remaining intact without moisture, but we've ruined it through our breath and our sweat.
So was this a project the Egyptian government initiated, or did Mr. Lowe propose it to them?
Well, I would say that Mr. Lowe is a impresario, but one who has cultural heritage in mind. He didn't do it for any profit. He actually created this facsimile as a gift to the Egyptian public with some funds from the European Union. And what he did is he said, let me scan the entire tomb with laser scanners that can recreate the details in the tomb in both the surface area and all the sort of paint, surface paint details.
And that's better than taking photographs?
Well, because it has a fidelity of 100 microns, and you're also, it's a tomb. It's a 3D object and an experience that you go through in real time, and so he recreated the entire experience. It's now installed in the Valley of the Kings, a mile to the east, so you can walk inside. You can see the relief paintings not only at the proper height and in the proper relation to one another, but you also can, you know, have the experience of sort of walking inside and all of the relief, which is really much a part of the experience. You know, there are lumpy limestone walls. There's a shadow effect that comes from that. You can't capture that in photography.
Is it the same size as the original tomb? What's it made of? It's, obviously not the same materials as the original.
It's the exact same size. You know, as I was saying, it has a fidelity of 100 microns, which is the naked eye looking at reading distance can't discern the difference. So it's very much a similar experience. I mean, I've been trained all my life. You know, I'm somebody who's interested in art history. I read my Walter Benjamin. I've kind of always thought that copies are a kind of tacky ersatz experience. And so I kind of went in with a bit of suspicion. But when you can record with this level of objective, almost relentless fidelity, you know, your eyes can see what they can see, and it provides a kind of interesting experience.
Did the process of scanning the tomb reveal information that archaeologists weren't aware of before?
It did. One of the kind of quirks of the technology is that you scan the topography of the walls with one, and this is just the Adam Lowe method, with one device, and then the surface color with another. So these two digital files needed to be conjoined. So when you look at the black and white topography of the walls of King Tut's tomb, without the visual distraction of all the hieroglyphs image, there became apparent that there were two rectangular shapes that looked very suspiciously like doorways that had been plastered over. And an Egyptologist has sort of a nickname, Nicholas Reeves, published a paper last year. It ended up all around the world as news that he thinks that there may be a tomb that is beneath King Tut's tomb.
Queen Nefertiti's tomb, the one that's never been found.
That's correct. And, you know, he has a theory for that. The argument is that King Tut was buried very hastily because he died at the age of 19, very unexpectedly, and his tomb is unusually small. And and Reeves basically outlines an argument for it has to do with the orientation of the tomb, that it could be Nefertiti's, but it could be anything. It could be two storerooms, but it's still worth knowing.
Is the Factum Arte team creating replicas of other archaeological sites in the Valley of the Kings?
Yes. They have signed a multi-year agreement with the Egyptian government now, and they are going to scan the most beautiful and large tomb in the Valley of the Kings. It's the tomb of Seti I, which I had the pleasure of visiting, which is unusual because it has been essentially closed to the public since the late 80s because it has this gorgeous celestial ceiling that has been flaking off and cracking and falling apart, and they were worried about tourists bashing their heads in.
And didn't Adam Lowe develop his own scanner called the Lucida Scanner?
That's right, yes. He takes a real craftsman approach to this. I mean, in the article, I compare him to James Cameron in the sense that he doesn't like to think of himself as a kind of fusty academic type, but he likes to think that I will do whatever it takes with technology to achieve what I want. And so he spent 10 years creating this Lucida scanner that had a central virtue, which was that it didn't get distorted by glare that flash photography often creates.
I imagine it's named after the camera Lucida, what artists have used for years to copy things.
That's right, yes.
First of all, I should tell people that my guest is Daniel Zalewski. He has written an article called The Factory of Fakes that's in the November 28th issue of The New Yorker. We are just doing a quick scan of it because there's a lot of detail we won't be able to get to. You write about the team's work with statues from the site of Nimrud in what is now Iraq. Weren't there some works there that they scanned that were subsequently destroyed by ISIS?
Yeah, well, they didn't scan them in Nimrud proper. What they did is they scanned works that are in the British Museum and the Pergamon in Berlin that, because of imperialism back a century or two ago, had been taken away from the Nimrud site. But Now that ISIS, rather reprehensibly, blew up the entire site of Nimrod, I mean, there are horrifying YouTube videos in which you can see ISIS militants at, you know, pointing a drill at the face of beautiful Assyrian artworks. We have a cultural dilemma. The recent advance in Mosul, Nimrod just got taken back from ISIS. And so we now have a pile of wonderful rubble on our hands. And the question is, what do you do? Do you try to assemble all the fragments and try to restore it that way? Or do you do what Adam Lowe has proposed, which is to make perfect scan replicas of all of the masterworks, the best objects from Nimrod that Westerners took out before the destruction, and then reassemble those replicas on the site? And would that not, in fact, create a more meaningful sort of homage to what was once there?
Well, they could also try to put together the destroyed pieces. We see that with a lot of archaeological work. For example, when pyramids are reconstructed, they have to figure out which brick went in which place.
Absolutely. And there's a whole school of art history that is dedicated to that. If you look at the Parthenon in Egypt, and in Greece, that is the method that was done there. Adam Lowe would argue that, you know, when you're, first of all, mistakes are often made because it's guesswork. It's doing a jigsaw puzzle without any certainty about which fragments belong in which box. But there's also, it would end up looking like a bunch of fragments that have been joined together. A replica of an object that has been preserved in very good condition in a Western museum would perhaps be a more meaningful reconstruction.
We're talking about three-dimensional things,
yes.
But what about paintings? They have also made reproductions of paintings, including Veronese's Wedding at Cana, which is now located at the Louvre. Why did they choose that one to copy?
Well, it has a fascinating story. What was once the most prized Renaissance painting in the world, and Napoleon took it off the wall of a refectory in Venice that was designed by Palladio, one of the great architects, and brought it back for this new museum that was being created, the Louvre. And it now sits in this grand salon next to the Mona Lisa. It's now been eclipsed by the Mona Lisa. And so this wonderful architectural work by Palladio was essentially denuded, had no real aesthetic coherence anymore. And so for that reason, Adam Lowe said, let me, you know, show the utility of this work, not just by replicating a painting, but by replicating it and putting it back and giving meaning to a place.
I wonder if the Greeks would like to have him do that with the Elgin marbles.
He, in fact, has proposed that. And he likes to suggest a thought experiment, which is that if he were to create his own digital replicas, he believes that the relevant officials in that ongoing diplomatic battle would not be able to tell the difference between his and the originals.
They also reproduced one of Caravaggio's most celebrated works, The Nativity with St. Francis of St. Lawrence, which had been stolen from a chapel in Palermo in 1969. How did they recreate it without having the original to work from?
Well, this was a different kind of project for them, because rather than doing an absolutely high-fidelity facsimile of something that they had in their possession they could do a scan of, what they did is they amassed data from all the known photographs of the work and created a kind of compiled electronic database of all the known possible bits of information. And then they scanned that, and then using their knowledge of other Caravaggios that they had scanned, they created a relief that they felt was true to the spirit of the work. But that one is clearly more of an interpretive act than the other things, which are acts of recording and replication.
Can a printed copy of a painting reproduce the texture of the brushstrokes, the consistency of oil paint, or the sheen of the varnishes that were used by the painter during the Renaissance?
You know, it eerily can. I mean, this is one of the things that I sort of wondered, is that the very notion of, you know, a brushstroke being a sort of a record of human motion, and that we think of it as being something that you couldn't replicate in pixels. But if you have it at that level of density, you look at the replication of a Caravaggio, and it appears to have the same level of dynamism of the original.
Can they give me a Caravaggio?
You know, it's very important when they create these digital files that only the museums or cultural heritage sites that own them are allowed to have the data. So it's all locked up. Sorry.
Another issue is that the original artworks change over time. So doesn't a digital reproduction freeze the image at a particular point in time while the original will continue to age?
Absolutely. And, you know, you can, like in my piece, there was one art historian who kind of described these replications as almost ageless clones, you know, and it had a kind of antipathy toward him. But it's also, if you think about it, wouldn't it be nice to know what the Mona Lisa looked like 50 years ago, 100 years ago, to watch it travel through time, especially if you're not altering the original object itself? It's an experiment that allows you not to touch the original, but then you can conjure a work's history with some fidelity.
And that might solve some of the controversies of the past few years. For example, when the Sistine Chapel was cleaned, and some art historians claimed that it actually wasn't what Michelangelo had intended, while others said this is exactly the way it would have looked when he painted the ceiling.
Indeed. The art in Chicago, the Art Institute recently did an interesting experiment where they've never restored the famous Seurat painting, Grand Jatte, and they created a digital sort of version in which they restored the browned ochre tones of the original, but they didn't, you know, it would be quite hard to restore every dot of a Seurat painting, if you think about it. So, and you'd certainly be redoing the entire thing. So instead of actually altering the original, they presented in the same hall a digital rejuvenation, as they called it, that would allow you to see what it originally looked like. But it then respects the idea that a painting is, in fact, a work that travels through time and changes in a wonderful way.
I was hoping that we could get a copy of King Tut's tomb for the Metropolitan Museum of Art.
That would be fantastic. And,
but you know, that would not be part of the deal?
It would not be part of the deal because Egypt would not want that to happen. Understandably, it places real value in its cultural heritage, and specifically something that's as magnetic a tourist spot as Luxor. So they want people to go to a place like Luxor, see both original tombs and replica tombs, and create an investment in why it is that visiting is a dangerous act.
Is one of the advantages of digital scanning is that it doesn't involve actually touching the work, so it's less invasive than making a traditional plastic cast?
Yeah, absolutely. The idea of Adam Lowe's entire enterprise is that he is recording without touching anything, and any intervention that you do on a work of art, even the most well-intentioned, and most conservators are wonderful people who only want to do the best thing, but there is a kind of eerie and discomforting way in which we look back at any restoration from 40 or 50 years ago or 100 years ago, and we see them as the cultural product of that time. And so when you were talking about the Sistine Chapel, will we one day look at that 100 years from now and notice a cultural correspondence between that restoration and that of Walt Disney films and the heightened color of Hollywood? We probably will.
Did you travel to any of these places with Adam Lowe?
I did. I went into the Valley of the Kings with him, and I visited both the Seti I tomb, which he is just beginning to scan. So he was setting up a total of 5 scanners in that tomb. And I also visited, you know, in a kind of fun little thought experiment, I visited the King Tut's original tomb and the fake one on the same day.
And were you impressed? Does it really look exactly the same?
The visual correspondence is really very, I mean, you know, I looked for flaws, and obviously I'm not an Egyptologist. I'm also not an historian in the same way. I'm sure that people could notice a few differences, possibly. But, you know, the lead conservator of the Getty Art Institute, which is restoring the original tomb, she told me that she found it incredibly impressive. So even experts find it a remarkable experience. The main difference is that it doesn't smell.
Adam Lowe says that he hopes to redefine the relationship between the original and the copy. And it all makes sense. So why is this still a controversial concept?
I don't think it's really becoming less and less controversial. I mean, the Prado is using it. The Louvre are using he basically creates now. The Lucida scanner has been used. It was used just a month ago up at the Cloisters. I think the difference is that museums embrace the idea of recording their work. The question is, do they then want to replicate it and put it on the wall of their museum and claim that that replica has value? But I think going forward, when you see major retrospectives in which there's one work of art in an artist's oeuvre that can't travel for some reason, you will see that people will use digital facsimiles as a quite good replacement for the original.
You mentioned that he has worked with Maya Lin and Anish mm-hmm. Kapoor. Do they want copies of their works?
No, what he does with them is he uses his knowledge of 3D printing. Like Anish Kapoor will create an orb-like shape and will require 3D printing to execute it. And because Adam Lowe's company makes these replicas, he also knows how to create contemporary sculptures. And what Adam essentially does is he makes money through the contemporary sculpture work, and then because he cares about cultural heritage, he uses almost all the profits for this cultural heritage project.
I wonder what Sotheby's thinks about all of this.
Yeah, I think that there's going to remain a kind of, skepticism towards the copy. But, I think it would be pretty hard to sneak a digital scanner into a museum in the dark of night. So I think most people's originals are pretty safe.
Although it would be better than just grabbing the painting and then having it disappear for a long time.
Indeed, and quieter, yeah.
The Factory of Fakes is in the November 28th issue of The New Yorker, and my great thanks to Daniel Zaluski, who is the magazine's features director and the author of the article, for being our guest today on our show. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for having me.